Hello, I'm Dimitris Satyropoulos, senior lecturer at the Open University Business School. I'm really happy to have today with me Jeanette Rutherford, professor of financial management. Jeanette's great and deep knowledge of modern financial practices is also the result of her distinguished professional career in the financial industry. She has a very strong research record on the history of investment, emphasizing also its gender aspect. The discussion will be about her recent quantitative research program on the history of women investors. Jeanette, you were involved in a major research project with the title Women Investors in England and Wales, 1870 to 1930. The project was funded by the Economic and Social Research Council grant. Can you please tell us a little bit for the motivation and the scope of the project?
Yes. The motivation was the investigation of the relationship between gender and investment behaviour during a particular period, 1870 to 1930, when major changes in investment took place. Investment as a whole boomed at that time with the Limited Liability Acts of the 1850s, the marketing of shares to an increasingly wealthy middle class, the introduction of different new types of security with lower risk to attract risk-averse individuals, and the increased awareness of investment opportunities with the marketing of bonds and savings certificates to fund World War I. And from the female side, there were a number of changes too. There were the Married Women's Property Acts of 1870 and 1882, which gave married women rights to hold investments in their own name. And there was also the increasing number of surplus, or they were called surplus or redundant women, who needed an investment income to live off, as work was either frowned on or not available, and then after World War I was exacerbated by the deaths of men in the war. We wanted to identify changes in investment behaviour by looking at two samples of investment records. First, we had a full sample of extant probate records, those that were left, assets at death between 1870 and 1902. The remainder of the sample had been destroyed. But testing, we found that the sample that we had was representative of the population in terms both of wealth and of geography across the UK. The second set of investment records, which we're going to talk about today, was shareholdings in individual company securities over the period 1870 to 1935.
Was there any relevant research? And if yes, how did your project differ from existing research?
Well, previous research had concentrated on a number of areas. One was the total number of shareholders. How many shareholders were there in the UK or overall? But that was made complicated by the fact that many investors held more than one security, so there were more shareholdings than shareholders. The probate sample gives us information on the number of securities held per person at death, and 508 of our 1,446 probate records held securities of some kind. Another concentration of previous research was to analyse types of shareholders, as we also wanted to do, and these researchers adopted one of three methods. They looked at individual companies over time, or they looked at individual sectors, such as canals, railways, which were huge at the time, and banks, or they looked at a cross-section of companies. For example, Davis and Huttenbeck looked at records of 260 companies in the late 19th century, early 20th century, Parkinson looked at UK shareholders in the early 1940s, and Kimmel looked at US shareholders in 1951. This research, particularly in the 19th century, tended to do 100% sampling, as the share registers didn't have many shareholders, a few dozen perhaps, or up to a couple of thousand. Parkinson and Kimmel, though, had to deal with much larger shareholder numbers, and they sampled 1 in 10 of their population. So other researchers were looking cross-sectionally or were limited to particular sectors or particular periods. And we wanted to be much broader than that, and so did the following. We chose the period 1870 to 1930 and sampled in the early years of each decade, so once every 10 years. We chose the years ending 1, 2, 3 in any decade so that later on we'd be able to use the census data, which is every 10 years in the year ending 1, for example, 1871, 1881. In that way, we could, if we wanted, find out more about individual shareholders from the census, the shareholders that we'd picked up from the shareholder records.
That's very interesting. How did you choose the companies in your sample?
Well, we looked at a number of possible differences, and we tried to pick companies which covered the whole spectrum. So, for example, for sectors, we looked at all possible types of sector and broke them down into agricultural, commercial and breweries. Breweries were big in the late 19th century. Extractive, which means mining. Manufacturing, such as steel mills. Transport and communications, of which railways were the major part. And utilities, for example, gas companies, which in those days were privately owned. We also looked at the span of time. We wanted companies which had at least two dates of shareholder records 10 years apart, so we could get some kind of continuity. We looked at longevity, whether companies succeeded or not, so we avoided survivorship bias. So some companies which died, went bankrupt or taken over were included, and some such as Foreign and Colonial Trust, which started in 1868, has lasted throughout the period and is in fact still going. We looked at different sizes, some small, some large. Some were small and became large, some were large and became small. We looked at geography, and what we mean by that is where the companies operated. They were all registered in England or Wales, but they operated in either domestically, so for example, companies such as Boots the chemist. We had empire operations such as Maratha, an Indian railway company. And we had companies which operated in foreign countries such as the Cuba Submarine Telegraph. Investors in those days weren't frightened to invest globally, even though the companies were all registered in the UK. Another difference we looked for was different security types. I've mentioned the fact that there were ordinary shares, but there were also preference shares and debentures, which were lower risk and very attractive to individual investors. So we looked at companies which had different variants of securities. And finally, we looked at both public companies and private companies. What I mean by that is companies where the securities were quoted on a stock exchange, where you could buy and sell them with relative ease. And we also looked at some private companies where really you could only change hands amongst the shareholders. It was very difficult to sell in the outside world.
In the collection of primary data, can you please describe in more detail what you did?
Our research differed because we were not looking cross-sectionally but longitudinally over time. So we found that the shareholder numbers went from a few dozen to tens of thousands over time. So it went from very small numbers to very large numbers. We were also collecting a lot of information as well as just the name of the shareholder. Address, gender, marital status, details of holdings, company details, etc., etc. So we had a huge amount of data to collect, and we clearly couldn't do 100% sampling. Systematic sampling, such as sampling 1 in 10, which I said that Kimmel and Parkinson did, wouldn't have worked either, given the changes in numbers of shareholders per company. A sampling 1 in 10 in the early years would have told us almost nothing. The other approach which we could adopt was random sampling. You could do this by, say, numbering shareholders 1 to whatever number, n, and then picking random numbers to sample the shareholder records. But there were practical reasons against this. We would have had to count shareholder numbers per register, which would have been time-consuming for large registers. Say, Barclays at one point had 30,000 shareholders. And then finding each individual shareholder in those 30,000 shareholders would have also have taken time. So we chose a compromise between random and systematic sampling. The first thing we did was that we estimated the total number of shareholders by calculating the average number of shareholders per page using 5 pages. We then counted the number of pages and multiplied that by the average per page to get an estimate of the total number of shareholders. We then identified how many shareholders we needed to sample per register to give us a 95% confidence level and a 7% confidence interval with respect to the population as a whole. We chose these boundaries as they were satisfactory, and tighter requirements led to much higher numbers of shareholders needing to be sampled. In practice, this level of confidence meant we had a maximum of 200 shareholders per register. We then generated a random number for each letter of the alphabet of the surnames of the shareholders. A minimum of 3 letters per register were sampled to avoid just looking at family clusters. So, for example, if we'd just taken a B and all the owners, the big directors and things, had a name beginning with B, it would have biased our sample. With each random letter of the alphabet chosen, a random number start page was determined. And this was quite important because we had shareholder records which came from different sources. So some were the Form E submitted to the Registrar of Companies, which was a formal document. Some we were using the actual shareholder registers that the companies were managing. And so what we had is some shareholder records were sticky. For example, some lists just added new shareholders at the end of the letter. So sampling from the beginning of the letter only would have selected the original shareholders and we wouldn't have got the new shareholders that came in. And we would have liked to track the same shareholders over time because we sampled registers every 10 years from the 1870s to the 1930s. And some company registers were sampled over a period of 40 years. But many share records were not in strictly alphabetical order and numbers rose dramatically in many cases. So we just couldn't do what is called cluster sampling.
What were the major findings of the research project?
Well, we learned a lot about investors in general, not just women. For example, how where they lived affected what they bought. So if you had London-based shareholders, they were very keen on empire securities, such as railways from India. Whereas northerners bought local companies, for example, steel mills in Sheffield or shipping in Liverpool. We obviously learned a lot about women investors because that was the aim of the project. And we found that their numbers changed dramatically over the period. Women went from being 15% of all individual investors in the 1870 to 45%, nearly half, by the 1930s. In terms of value of investments, they started in the 1870s with 5% by value, and by the 1930s they were up to 35% by value. So although perhaps in how much they held wasn't quite as great as men, the change was really dramatic. And in fact, we found that in some shareholder registers, women were in the majority, particularly for lower-risk securities such as preference shares. So we're back to these women who were looking for low-risk investments for an unearned income. And they also liked brand names such as J. Lyons, which had tea shops which they used, or Boots the Chemist, which actually sold shares over the counter at one point. We're still working on the data in terms of the geography investment, and I mean how it differed over time. And also we're looking at how investors diversified their portfolios. Was the increase in number of shareholdings, which we identified in this research project, due to a larger and larger investor population, or was it the same small group of investors who simply added more and more shares to their portfolios over time?